said Walt Whitman was the big daddy of American poetry. I'm curious who the big mama is.
Emily Dickinson.
Well, that's a good answer. I said, let me say something first about Whitman and then also Emily. I believe personally that the finest poem ever written in this country is not one that I wrote, or one that any of my contemporaries wrote, but it's a poem about 8 or 9 pages long called The Song of the Open Road by Walt Whitman. In that poem, he announces the road, symbol of ultimately a continuing future. But he also announces where the poem comes from, and by implication, where America comes from. And he names the people that it comes from. The drifter, the bum, the felon, the African American, the Native American, the poor guy in the street. This is the inspiration of his work, of this work that he's writing. And you'll see it if you read The Song of the Open Road. You should if you haven't. It's a great poem. He was the great namer, you know, the great namer of the things at a time when America was, I mean, including the Civil War, it was at the great, most horrific point in its early maturation. And he was, of course, betrayed, as I tried to show in my Camarado Arcane, because with the development of monopoly capitalism, which was anything but Whitman's dream, Whitman had an abiding dream of democracy at the point at which it touches what true democracy is, the cooperative society, the communist society that never has been yet. That's what Whitman's dream is really of. And when you said the mother, someone said Emily Dickinson, quite right. I mean, I find that Emily Dickinson had a much more introverted voice and was perhaps an example in the psychological, social sense, is actually prophetic of this sensibility that occurs within the betrayal of the Whitman dream. One can explain her away simply by speaking about her particular peculiarity of her sensibility, and she was reclusive, and her poetry reflects that. But it's one very interesting about Emily Dickinson. Her language today, though it was written in the 19th century, has about it elements that are so forgivingly contemporary. It's quite unbelievable, really. She, of all the poets, has an idiom, a language that she created that has a real enduring effect even into the 21st century. You know, when I read, for example, poets like the British 19th, Keats, Shelley, I mean, I see them, they're in the 19th century. They're not saying things to me in the 20th century. They're saying universal things to go back to the Greek period, etc. But I'm talking about language now. Whitman was a guy who laid it out in language. He laid it out by naming. There could not have been, for example, the greatest poet of the 20th century was an American poet, too. He happened to have written in the Spanish language, but don't forget, Spanish-speaking countries in the Americas are American countries. And there's no question in my mind that Pablo Neruda was the great namer of the things of the 20th century. But Pablo Neruda could never have existed without the Whitman predating, but well, in a way, Whitman gave, has given to American poetry, and I believe that Jack Kerouac was born from the Song of the Open Road. Those of you who have not read the book called The Road, not by Jack Kerouac, by another Jack, Jack London, 1915. You want to see where even Jack Kerouac came from? He probably read that book. It's a great book by Jack London about him being a bum, a hobo, going across the country. And that book, too, I think Jack London was also born of Whitman. I know Jack Kerouac was born of this Song of the Open Road. And even Allen, who was the bard of the Cold War years, the bard of American poetry, even Allen has a tremendous debt to. Though Allen wrote within the nightmare, within the betrayal of the Whitman dream, Allen wrote Howl, which is the narco-imperialist nightmare poem. I mean, a struggle for love within that narco-imperialism. But Allen was deeply indebted to Whitman. His line, even, is a combo of Whitman and Blake. The line of Howl, and the listing, the catalog, who did this, who did that. That comes out of a dimension of Whitman, who really wrote a lot of litanous, I mean, after litany, listing a lot of things. Yes, go on. Anyone else? So what did I read you? Did it get to you at all? Did it stir a bone? What?
I really liked the last pieces that you chose. Really.
Are you saying that because it's the last piece?
No.
Because you know about us now these days, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had many things. Oh, I love the last word in the last piece you wrote.
No, I appreciate the combination, because in the first poem you gave tribute to Whitman, and the second one you were, as you were just describing right now, the betrayal of the Whitman-esque dream of spreading democracy.
When did you say the first poem I made a reference to Whitman? Yeah. The first poem I read?
No, the last two.
Oh, the last, yes.
And I really appreciate that combination.
Yes. I'm very conscious of Whitman's vision. And that poem, yes, the effect of the Quinceros arcane also was very strong last week. I was inaugurated as the poet laureate of the city of San Francisco last week. It was a room. I was big like this, with a lot of people in it. And in fact, it was the largest crowd that had ever appeared at the San Francisco Library Auditorium. They had to set up television cameras in another room. And that I closed that session with reading of the Quinceros, because it's a forceful. I took two aspects that interest me very much, which is human sexuality, because the poem is, as you know, is a metaphor of an orgy, and then you know the image of orgy of war, and that's what that arcane is about. At the same time, getting some digs in at. I've lived a few years and have been through a few struggles on the level of the streets of San Francisco, but also in relation to the world, like conscious and travel to certain places. And so that image of the... I like when I read it just now. I really like when I hit the number about empire. Indeed, we're the underworld of the world, and believe me, we are. We are the underworld of the world. And I mean underworld in a classic American sense, too. You know, the underworld like Xibalba in Mayan culture? It's the underworld. The underworld, where the dead go. But then there's also the underworld that we all know from Al Capone, the gangster world. Well, yes, that I appreciate. But when I wasn't kidding about the last, though. You know, when people say something, I don't mean about you, be very conscious when you say something to someone about referring to the last thing that they did. Because they want you, and I mean the forces that exist, the power, the ruling class, they who own control technology, which controls our life. They want you to think in terms of the last thing, because they don't want you to. They don't want you to have the memory. They don't want you to have the memory of anything anymore. And we have to fight for that. Just as I indicated in another poem, that we have to fight for our secularity. Because in that fight for the secularity, we actually, we save our human reason and our embodied reason. I don't mean just reason in an abstract way. I'm talking about our bodies and our souls against this whole religious squeeze that people are being put through today in the world. So it's very important, memory, remember, and I'm not saying this because I read to you today, remember the poems also that went before the last two. I don't even remember the poems, but dwell on the other parts of this reading that you heard, because it has to do with, they have to do with your own memory is very important. I don't mean merely about my poems, but in anything you do future-wise, be very suspicious of the idea of this instantaneity, because now they have almost institutionalized it, at least from the point of view of media. Yeah, what I mean is you could push a button and find out in a short time to watch a little movie and you saw the whole Russian Revolution right on your computer. There it is. So, that's another thing. Next. And it's really very important, because if we're kept in that state, we're always thinking about, we're always involved with the last thing that happened and the next thing that's going to happen. While there's a certain kind of hedonism that we all live in that's part of that, without any real, you know, for me, now in my 70s, the most important thing really has to do with the study of history, such as it is, or has been, even more important than studying techniques and poetry. Because the memory is becoming more and more important. And I'm not someone who's on my way to Alzheimer's, but memory in all things seems to me to be very important to help one get as embodied in the present as possible. Yes.
So, your poem about the blue flowers.
About the blue
flowers and love.
Yes, that was a little love poem.
That was very sweet. I was wondering if you could comment on how the personal aspects of growth.
Of what?
Of growth, like personal development. have anything to do with the crisis of imperialism as a solution?
Well, for a good question.
And when I
go on, go on.
Well, just I guess I was curious, like, you know, it's like what you feel your greatest strength and your greatest weakness are.
My own personal?
Well, yeah, and how that relates to, you know, the world.
All right, I'll start from the end there. I don't see things in terms of my greatest strength or my greatest weakness. I just don't see life that way. The same way I don't see life in terms of guilt or evil. I just, those are very foreign things to me. I don't feel such things. I don't know what they mean. If you talk about growth and in relation to imperialism, we're all sitting here in a room, we seem relatively, you're hearing some guy come up from San Francisco, he read you some poems, you're in a rather progressive school, I've heard that it is very progressive in the sense that there's a kind of liberty that perhaps doesn't exist in other places here, curriculum-wise and things, that and what you feel at ease with studying, etc., etc. At the same time, we know that we're in a war now, and that people of our own country are dying every day in that war. And moreover, people in Iraq are dying also every day. And the people in Iraq aren't they as human? Yeah, they're my brother and my sister. So my brother and sister are dying on both sides of that. Now, that means if my brother and sister are dying, my soul somewhere in itself is really quite devastated. And I think that our souls are devastated. And I think that growth, as you put it, is very difficult. Very difficult now, growth. Where I find one's growth, personal growth, deep most now. For example, in the rallies of the immigrants, the undocumented, engagement with that is something that makes one personally grow. Let me explain, because there were many people that say, well, these people, well, we were immigrants and we came through legal things, and then, you know, why shouldn't these people do that? Why shouldn't they have? But such people who say such things, they forget what has actually occurred from the time that their parents or grandparents came to this country. You remember, don't you? We won, quote, the Second World War. Right? We've never stopped being engaged for any particular length period in not being engaged in a war. We've been in, well, what do wars do to the human soul? What is the Vietnam? Yeah, I can tell you what the Vietnam, you've seen it, or if you didn't know, when I was working with the homeless, because I still work with the homeless, but I was really working in the trenches with the homeless many years ago, there was like at least one third of the homeless people in San Francisco were veterans of the Vietnam War. That's where they ended up. And believe me, they already said that there was something like 70,000 guys and gals need therapy who are involved in this war. I mean, the folks who are in the army. So it's difficult to speak about growth in that way. At the same time, we, each one of us, struggles to learn as much as possible, stay engaged. And if you listen to me at the deeper parts in that poem Path, which ends with write the poem, if you haven't written it, write it. And if you don't think you can, you're full of shit. Everybody's a poet. All you need is a piece of paper and a pen. Everybody is a poet. Everyone. So cast the blocks aside, and if you really want to find out what human liberty is, pick up a pen and a piece of paper, and you'll experience something you haven't experienced if you've not done it before. You probably did. Most everybody did that at one point in childhood. If you just retouch, make that contact with yourself. Because truly, everybody is. And I'm one of those who believes that it's the most powerful single thing in the world. The writing of a poem. I think it's the thing that completely deconstructs power. Yeah.
Your poem Past was the one that got my bones shaking.
Which one?
Past.
A path.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where you say, if you don't have a broken heart, get one.
Get one, yes.
And it got my bones going and it got my tear ducts wet.
Oh, that's very kind. That's very kind. No, yet brokenheartedness, I was influenced by, in that poem, by a man who, he was a philosopher who wrote, unlike, it's very rare, he wrote in the Yiddish language in about the 18th century. His name was Dov Baer, B-A-E-R. And he wrote a book called The Tract on Ecstasy. How do you arrive at ecstasy? How do you get to ecstasy? And he said ecstasy comes through brokenheartedness, which opens up into humility or sincerity, humility. And then you go through these gates of the soul, of all these things, and you come out into a state of, it's quite an extraordinary book. Called The Tract. It's translated, but it's very rare. I think you'd have to get it on an eBay, but it's really worth reading. And from there, I wrote my poem on a sort of a, not a gloss on his ideas, but because I had them too. But I'm pleased that you liked it. A lot of people do, especially when I said, if you don't have one, get one. Go to your broken heart. If you don't have one, get one. In a certain sense, we all do in this life, in one way or another. Yes?
Hi, I'm honored to meet you for the first time. And
say it louder, so everyone
hears.
I'm
honored to meet you for the first time.
I'm honored to meet you. I'm honored to meet you. Yes.
You know, as I sit here and listen to you, I see and hear a sage. Something that's not because of the years that you've been on the planet, but just the wisdom that's probably been there since you were born. It feels like it's a really deep well of stuff. But I also wanted to say that it seems like we're coming into an age of sages. Who are sort of like the last physical connection that we have to the past that you've been talking about. You've hit on World War I, the 1900s. Yeah. You've hit on Vietnam War. You talk about so many different things in your poetry. It's really, you know, powerful and moving. And all these things are really... These roots just keep, that's what I'm seeing. These roots keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. But they're trying to replace you with, and not only you, but other men and women like you, with these bites of memories that are 1 second follow-ups. Mm-hmm. And I, when you said that in your explanation about it, it rang home because it just seems as if we don't have you physically around anymore, they're going to be able to wipe out the memory very easily, because we won't be able to tap into a physical sense of history anymore.
Well, thank you. I mean, sage is that's a nice word, but I don't regard myself as a sage, just someone who, you know, you are living in these times now. I mean, in a sense, you're being younger. And these times are very difficult because these times are ruled by technology, are ruled by it. Our entire lives are ruled by technology. This is not, in fact, something new. A man named Gary Davies, who was a teacher in San Mateo College, wrote a book in 1983, I think, in which it was called Technological Humanism or Technological Nihilism. And in 1983, he said, and he showed in the book, that technology ruled every aspect of our lives, except at that point, the orgasm. And that was 1983. Now, if they haven't ruled the orgasm too, they probably deformed it with all the porn, you know, because the pornopoly is everywhere, you know. So, and that belongs to technology, you know. It's the combination of hedonism mixed with hedonism rooted in economics, mixed with or presented through technology. All that I'm saying here is that you're living through all of this now, all the more reason for the challenge. I mean, after all, what is it you're here in the universe? You remember when you first came in? What was it? You may have gotten jaded in your age. You remember you wanted life to deepen. What the hell else is there? Life's got to be deep. It's got to be deep, because then the fullness of it comes through in everything. I remember that was the way I felt when I first got into a college class. I was there and I was excited because I wanted to learn things, because I wanted life to deepen. In that sense, you guys are going to be the sages, you know. It's just that the deepening process is more difficult, perhaps, because what's thrown at you is all this, is the bites, like you said, the B-Y-T-E you were talking about, right? Yeah, and that instantaneity. And that's why it's so important that the profoundly modern figures should really involve your study. Really, you should look at a revolutionary like Karl Marx. If don't believe anybody who says that his ideas are finished or overturned. Or, I mean, you have only to read the Communist Manifesto. It's the most inflammatorily magnificent poem of the 19th century, along with the Song of the Open Road, and they go together. They go together. I mean, really, when you see, and then you put it to, I make references in my work to a new class. Remember in the poem of the Poetry of the Millennium, the new class would say, fuck you to the tear gas and things like that, or I didn't use that word, but something like that. This new class of poor people all over the world, it's not simply in the States, although in the States we do have 37 million in dire poverty and another 40 million at the poverty level or under. That's also the new class. But many of those people are working. They're just working in fear of losing their job. And they have a right to have that fear, because you pick up the paper every week, you'll see 10,000 are going to be laid off. Those are comprised what we call a new class created in an age when technology ruled, but technology can actually, for the first time in human history, provide everyone with a house everyone with food for the rest of their his or her life. This is the first time in human history that technology can do that. And people can be liberated to live the fullest creative liberty in all of their lives through robotization. I'd prefer to see my friend who's a hard-working factory guy be home painting, which is something he really likes to do. Let a robot do that stuff. The problem is that if you have the robots working for profit, which is what they are in the hands of capitalists, then it's not getting a fair shake. What you're doing is that the worker is being thrown out of his job. You know, that classic story, the John Deere Company. They were making tractors. They had 1,000 workers at a plant. They closed the plant for a few months. They went back. There were 3 workers. 997 people were laid off because of the robotization. They robotized the plant. That's how all those places have been in the Middle West, have been decimated, even down to the Ford companies and all. But what does that mean? I mean, this guy says, sitting here and saying this, what does that mean to me? I'm in the state of Washington. I'm even in a school here, a relatively progressive school in Washington. What has that got to do with me? It has plenty to do with you, believe me. It has plenty to do. And the keys to what it has to do does lie in Marxist writing. It lies in some of the other really extraordinary figures who are writing today about what's going on in the world. A man named Slavoj Žižek, Z-I-Z-E-K. He is from Ljubljana, which is in Slovenia, a country where I've read and I know some of the poets and writers there. He's well known in this country. He also writes about good stuff, deeply. Or take someone like Jean Baudrillard, who's a great French writer, who wrote the deepest thing that I've ever read on 9/11. Maybe by way of that, maybe I'll read you the 9/11 now. Yeah, just as I read you the 9/11. There's a combination, and then we can perhaps close it, or if you want to have more questions, or whatever. This is both a personal aspect and a public aspect. This is called the Twin Towers Arcane. It's an arcane. So you now know that there's a little more orchestration in it. Okay? 1. Such mourning as we might wake from, having been woken from by such a light, to see the light at last. That we are now no more nor less, but have been more than others, a violent land, in our money markets, in our law and orders, in our daily dailies, in our beds, a violent life, pretending to an impenetrable innocence and power symbolized by those giant twins. Their destruction, Hitler's dreamed before they even were built, before his suicide began to fight on the side of religious fanaticism. And we, who had inherited so much of his violence and anti-communism, we who've even ultimately financed the attack on our pretended innocence, we, so at home with fascism, denied, of course, with brutality forsworn, of course, with liberty sentimentalized from a core of destructive emptiness, hopelessness, cynicism at bottom, children of a star-spangled nihilism, of course, denied and forsworn, from California to the New York Island, brothers and sisters, my own, so sadly struck, so deeply struck. 2. The Israeli says, now they know, who himself has been infested with genes from the 12-year long syringe of unforgettable evil. Presumably, it's we who now know what it means to be totally detested to the point of apocalypse. And it's a fascist defense against a fascist attack that the world is preparing. For there's nothing but that nothingness of a scorpion planet eating its own tail, and it's the awareness of that truth that doubles the mourning and profounds the fear of the loss of the innocence that was a lie in the first place. This time we're really trapped by truth. And it grieves us who've been so comfortable in the liberty of the lie. This time the total mobilization of war consciousness says, even if pacifism grows, even if it prevents responsive attacks, even if nonviolence triumphs, the future will be like a black man who, or like eroticism which, while no longer lynched or censored, will nevertheless never feel altogether at home in worldly life. The rule of nothingness is complete now. God murdered on one hand, God suicided on the other, the triumph of fascism. We're ordered to live out our nonviolent lives, buying and selling and praying to violence, despite ourselves, because there's nothing else. Nothing's changed. It's only standing more revealed. 3. Celia, I know you ran toward, not away from, to help, to save, and that you saw the second plane evaporating the wall as you ran toward, and that you saw for the first time in your life human beings leaping from the high ledges and the twins collapsing into a single mountain of thousandfold death and rubble and dust. Nothing I was witness to on a television screen thousands of miles away on another continent can approach the horror of what you saw as you ran toward the scene till you could no more, dust clouds billowing through the streets, and those running for their lives from the core told you you could go no further, couldn't help, couldn't save. Oh, my brave, brave daughter, I know your grief isn't from afar. In vain they died, you cry. And your despair there perhaps spares, perhaps even saves us from the shock which turned the future into an archaic archaeological dig. 4. The night that has arrived, the technological night, all day. And with it mourning, the fast of the fast, the bitter taste of one's own desert. And it is not only one's own, but that we're all speaking with mouths of sand, and dunes are growing, undulating with the discourse of a dazzling darkness in the sun that is broken in each of us. All night, airplanes and helicopters have been flying over the burnt Siena porticos of Bologna, where I happen to be mourning. It's become the state of being. A black flag at half-mast, hanging in midair. I'm still open if you want to ask any more questions.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about homelessness, and you said you spent some time in the trenches. If you could tell us a little bit about that.
Ah, you're going to drive me to write to read another poem.
If you must.
If I must, but this poem, I was sort of waiting for a question like this. First of all, I'm going to read you the poem that's the most important poem, exclusive of the Arcanes. The most important poem that I have written is the poem that I wrote on homelessness. Try to understand it from this point. I was with an organization, the Communist Labor Party. They were the only party who saw homelessness coming back in the early 80s. They saw it. And we started giving out the newspapers to people on homeless lines and all. We knew at that time even very early on. And that party later on dissolved, like things dissolved. But we saw homelessness will never end in this country unless the system is changed, unless the wealth is redistributed. There will be homeless deaths every year all over this country. It's another stage. The deepest stage of the new class is homeless. If you got no home, you're out on the street. You're sleeping, you know, you're sleeping in the street. Or you're begging to get some bread to get into some place to stay for the night. It's the condition that has come about when, I mean, the most obscene kind of, where did I put that?
Good night.
This is a newspaper published by the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. It's really the best newspaper, I think, in the country. There's no advertisement. It's all done by homeless people and advocates. And I'll read that poem right after I read this one, but this is very recent, the one that called Home. It's because of that, because I know that unless and until capitalism is changed, it changes its whole mold. In other words, is overthrown, there will be homeless people and more people, because more and more people in the so-called new class are working people, driven to accept things where the capitalists, you know, they don't give a fuck. They'll just make you a slave, you know. This whole complication with the immigrants, for example, they very well know, the capitalist ruling class very well knows that many of these immigrants who performed some of the most basic functions in this society, that they work for piddling wages. They don't want them to become citizens of the United States, because then it would make the demands that the citizens of the United States would make.